Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as I said before the break, here's one potential policy change that the Trump administration might consider that you probably haven't thought about: undoing the inclusion of women in combat instituted under President Obama. Just over a year ago, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter announced that for the first time, all roles in the military would be open to women, including combat positions. Prior to this announcement, the ACLU had been engaged in a lawsuit on behalf of four servicewomen and the Service Women's Action Network, challenging the military's policies banning women from combat roles. A year after the announcement, neither the fight over gender equality in the military nor the lawsuit have gone away. And with the coming Trump administration, the future role of women in the military remains uncertain, especially because Defense Secretary nominee General James Mattis has opposed it. So here to discuss how attempts to integrate the military's front lines have fared, the ongoing lawsuit, and the future of the policy are Ellen Herring, director of the Service Women's Institute at the Service Women's Action Network. She's a retired Army colonel. Jillian Thomas, senior staff attorney for the ACLU Women's Rights Project, and Joe Plenzer, a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel who is executive vice president of membership, marketing, and outreach at the U.S. Naval Institute. I think I got all your titles right. Welcome, all of you, to WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
And Jillian, I'll start with you from the ACLU. What changed under President Obama?
Well, in 2012, the ACLU brought a lawsuit challenging a 1994 policy that had excluded women categorically from all ground combat roles. It was about 240,000 jobs that we're talking about, including access to some of the most senior roles in the military. So we brought that lawsuit in late 2012. Under Defense Secretary Panetta in early 2013, he announced that the policy was being rescinded and a period of investigation and preparation would begin for the actual integration process. That's what led up to the announcement in December 2015 that you just alluded to from now Secretary Ash Carter.
But Colonel Herring, that lawsuit is ongoing?
Yes, the lawsuit is ongoing. Jillian could speak to it better about
sure.
why it's ongoing.
Well, then let's stay with you for that. Because if they instituted the policy, why is there still a lawsuit?
Sure. So the lawsuit stayed in place after the 2013 announcement so that we could observe how the implementation plans were being developed, and the case was sort of stayed. No discovery took place. But then after Secretary Ash's announcement a year ago and the implementation plans were made public and then actually started to be put in place this past spring, we became concerned that there were some aspects, especially in the Army's plan and the Marines' plan, that while the combat exclusion has been lifted in a de jure way, in a formal way, that there were certain policies that were continuing a de facto separation of women and men. And specifically, we're very concerned in both the Army and the Marines that both branches are requiring a leaders first policy, meaning that before any junior enlisted woman can enter a formerly closed unit, there has to be at least one woman officer, or in the case of the Marines, two women in place for at least 30 days or 90 days, respectively. To us, that poses a significant delay in the number of now hundreds of young women who have enlisted who want to move into those units. If there aren't women there to receive them, then they're going to be rejected.
Colonel Plesner, as a retired Marine, my understanding has been that the Marine Corps was initially more resistant to the policy change and requested special exemptions for keeping certain positions male only. And General Mattis is a Marine. Can you give us some background on why the Marines had a different point of view than some of the other services and where that stands today?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I tell you that the Marine Corps has been resistant to most social changes throughout history. So if you go all the way back to desegregation, the Marine Corps initially resisted that. We talked about don't ask, don't tell. The Marine Corps resisted that. And now that there's another social change you know, in motion, they were, it's a fact, the most resistant of all of the services to this policy change. So part of it, I think, is a cultural issue within the Marine Corps.
And Colonel Herring, I think you've also I'll just ask you, how's it going in the Army from what you could tell?
Yeah, so actually, I'm pretty pleased with what I'm seeing in the Army. So this year, 2015, opened the positions, and this year the Army has moved forward pretty steadily with opening those positions and specifically recruiting and training the women leaders so that they get those leaders in there. In October and November of this year, we commissioned 25 women in the infantry and the armor. Those are all officers. Of those first integrated classes, we had women not just graduating from the course, but they're also excelling. Three women in the first integrated infantry officer course were on the commandant's list, which means they graduated in the top 20% of their class. Similarly, with the first armor officer course, we had two top graduates, and now those women are preparing to go to their first units, and once they get into those units, then we will begin to flow the enlisted women in. So the Army has really moved out. They've been surprised by the number of women that are interested, more than 300. That's twice what they were expecting. And so the Army has really got women in place or heading into those first integrated units to support the leader's first policy.
And if I could say something on that with the Marine Corps, the fact that the policy is such that there need to be women officers there to receive women enlisted into units. I mean, my wife just retired from 20 years in the Marine Corps, and I could tell you she's had absolutely no female direct reports in her time in the Marine Corps. So, I mean, this idea that it takes a woman to lead a woman is preposterous because it takes Marine officers to lead Marine enlisted and Marine subordinates. So, I think that should take a second look at that policy.
Joe Plesner, is it? I want to ask you about General Mattis. I don't know how familiar you are with him. You know, you're retired Marines. He's retired Marines, but right. The Trump transition folks have made very clear that no individual view of anybody who's being nominated for a cabinet position means that view will become policy. They'll all report to the president.
Sure.
The president will hear their views on whatever and make a policy determination. Do you feel, though, that General Mattis, if he's confirmed as defense secretary, is a particular threat to this policy?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I've worked for General Mattis twice in my time in the Marine Corps. So 2 years out of 20 was spent working directly for him. And I can tell you, he's a person of character. He definitely knows his stuff as far as his responsibilities as a Marine officer and now as the next nominee to be defense secretary. And we haven't had that conversation about his views on this issue. But what I can tell you is that I think that a lot of my female colleagues from the Marine Corps are concerned. I think that they have every reason to be concerned, and I think we're going to have to take a wait and see what the new policy will be. But I've had friends of mine who are former Marine Corps Cobra helicopter gunship pilots who they love General Mattis for what he represents for Marine Corps leadership, but they're also concerned about what this impact will be on the future women in service.
And Colonel Herring, I guess it's not just General Mattis. I've read that reinstating the ban was expressly included in the GOP platform, and Donald Trump himself has spoken disparagingly of it, calling it politically correct. Are you hearing any whispers of whether he is likely to reinstate the ban?
Well, just I think it was last week, the Freedom Caucus within the House also has put it as their number one item for DOD to return to a 1994 policy that not only excluded women from combat units, but there was a co-location clause which said that women couldn't even be co-located with all male units. So, yes, we're very concerned from a number of aspects.
There are a number of arguments on the side of reinstating the ban. One of them has to do with male chivalry, maybe you'd call it, that men are going to put themselves at risk unnecessarily or unequally, let's say, for a woman who's there in combat with them because they're going to feel that they, need to protect a woman. Colonel Plesner, you just said, oh, God.
Yeah, no, I think that it's a form of benevolent sexism, really. And, you know, that can be overcome with expectations and leadership and training. Every time I've been deployed either to Iraq or Afghanistan and served alongside female comrades, it just wasn't an issue at the units I was in. I mean, we were all members of the team, and the only thing that people really cared about is, you know, how smart are you, how tough are you, and do you stick around to fight when the chips are down? And it really, you know, when you're at the far edge of the spear, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, I was less concerned about what gender they were and more concerned about how competent they were at their jobs.
Jillian Thomas from the ACLU.
I think something that's not very well understood, and maybe it's because people have an outmoded idea of what combat is in this day and age, but 300,000 women were deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and over 1,000 of them have lost their lives, and many, many more have been injured. So the notion that the front line is a demarcated place that is very distinct from behind enemy lines or behind the front line is really outdated. And so as was stated by Joe, the men and women have been fighting side by side in combat, pulling comrades out of harm's way for years now.
Go ahead, Colonel Herring.
Yeah, sure. I'd like to add one more thing about that. There's been no examples of it. So why do people point to that all the time? If you could point to a single example of that happening, sure, it might be a worthy concern. But the second aspect of that always is confusing to me is when men risk their lives for other men, we give them a Medal of Honor. But now we say if a man risked his life to save a woman, it's a misguided chivalric action.
Yeah, I guess if you're fighting for the Confederacy in the Civil War, maybe you'd subscribe to that. But I mean, it is a ridiculous notion. I mean, it's one that really should just belong on the trash heap of history.
We're going to run out of time in a minute, and if they do propose undoing this policy, we'll come back to it on the show in a deeper way and have various points of view and take calls from people who've served. But this is you guys wanting to put this on the radar, that here's an issue that the media hasn't talked about yet that may in fact wind up one of those things from the Obama years that gets undone. I'm just curious to hear from the three of you, and you're all on the same side of this, so we should make that explicit. But do you think that this is a legitimate disagreement over safety and effectiveness in combat, or do you think it's some kind of, you know, retrograde social position underlying it that women are somehow women don't belong in combat, women belong in the home, or women just belong in softer, quote-unquote, positions because they're women? Jillian?
Certainly, we believe that this is very much founded on stereotypes and always has been, and like many fields that have open to women, there's in the past law enforcement, firefighting, construction, all manner of male-dominated fields, there's certain to be resistance. That's natural, and that's the way it happens. The concern here is that, especially with our lawsuit and with the year of women entering these jobs that we've seen, the sky has not fallen. In fact, quite the opposite has happened. And so it's our concern that the lawsuit, to the extent there are barriers that need to be overcome, that we be able to proceed. But the train has left the station here, and it should be allowed to keep going.
Colonel Herring, and you'll get the last word because we're out of time, but what do you think is really going on here?
Well, first of all, we're a standards-based military. If we just set legitimate occupational standards, we let all citizens apply for those jobs, I think that's the way we can get the most effective military.
And if few can do it, doesn't mean that none should be allowed to try.
Ellen Herring, Jillian Thomas, and Joe Plensler. How many times have I mangled your name today?
That's all right. Try spelling that in kindergarten.
And Jillian Thomas from the ACLU's book that came out earlier this year is Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.